This is A Confused Heap of Facts, the podcast where we have a discussion about history with the faculty of the Department of Military History and the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College. The views expressed in this podcast are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of the Department of the Army, Department of Defense, or U.S. government. Mini-series within the larger podcast that we're going to call Reassessing. And the idea here is to take a figure who is well-known both within and kind of without military history circles, whether for good or bad, and examine if their reputation is well-earned. So think, for example, probably the most controversial figure of the U.S. military in the 20th century, Douglas MacArthur. And we'll get around to him eventually. So the idea here is we'll walk listeners through what the reputation is, then we'll talk about who the person is, and we'll conclude by talking about in each episode whether or not their reputation is deserved. Again, good or bad. So we're delighted to have for our first one of these episodes, Dr. Martin Clemis, who is our expert in all things Vietnam. Dr. Clemis, welcome.
Well, thank you very much. Great to be here.
And we're going to start this series with probably the second most controversial commander in the 20th century of American military history, General William Westmoreland. So before we kind of dive into the details, Dr. Clemis, give us kind of the very brief overview. What is Westmoreland's reputation, particularly kind of in the pop public history world?
Okay, sure. No, thanks. Despite having a long and respectable military career and pedigree, if you will, Westmoreland has not been treated very favorably by historians really ever since the war. Even during the war, the press that his successor, Crichton Abrams, got was much more laudatory than it was for Westmoreland during the conflict.
So what's kind of the one line on Westmoreland? What's the general belief of what he did wrong?
Well, the traditional take is that Westmoreland was an unimaginative, inflexible, and conventionally minded commander. One who not only did not understand the nature of the war in Vietnam, particularly its political aspects, but one who essentially fought a wasteful, mindless war of attrition and ended up losing the war for the United States.
Okay, perfect. So now we have a general idea of what the book is on Westmoreland. Now let's talk about who he was. So who was William Westmoreland? Where did he come from? What's the experience you talked about?
Okay, sure. Well, he was a Southerner, born of the heir of a Confederate family. He was born in Spartanburg, South Carolina in 1914, the year that World War I broke out. Although he was expected to go to VMI, he did in fact go to West Point, graduated there in 1936. He was an artillery officer thereafter. He commanded the 34th Artillery Battalion, 9th Infantry Division in World War II, in Tunisia, Sicily. He went on later on to fight in France and Germany as well. After the war, he went to the Army Jump School at Fort Benning, became a airborne officer there as well. He served with the 82nd Airborne Division thereafter. Between 1950 and 1952, he was an instructor at both the Commander General Staff College here in Leavenworth, but then also a lecturer at the U.S. Army War College. Before being called to the war in Korea, he commanded the 187th Airborne Regimental Combat Team, known as the Rakasans, between 1952 and 1953. He was also promoted in 1952 to Brigadier General. At the age of 38, he was one of the youngest ever to be promoted to that particular rank. After the Korean War, he attended Harvard Business School. He became later on the late 1950s commander of the 101st Airborne Division, superintendent of West Point between 1960 and 1963, and then he goes to Vietnam in 1963 and assumes command of Military Assistance Command in Vietnam. Military Assistance Command Vietnam, excuse me, in 1964. replacing his predecessor, which is Paul Harkins.
So I'm going to ask Dr. Nance here, how does this career mark him as an early to mid-20th century officer, both his World War II experience and after?
Upper tier successful, if that makes nothing immensely remarkable, particularly for the first part of it. But one of the interesting things, you said West Point class of 36, right?
Yes.
So 6 years after leaving West Point, he is commanding a battalion. Mm-hmm. In reference, 6 years after leaving West Point, I was commanding a company. Mm-hmm. So just a little bit different there in terms of, now it helps when there's World War II on the line. But overall, an up-and-comer, which is successful battalion command. Now, he did not, command a division in World War II, so there's that. But he wasn't like, everyone's like, wow, he's super special. He's not a Jim Gavin. He's not a Ridgway, but he is this strikes me as being a very well thought of person who is checking kind of all the right blocks. Interestingly enough, and something, Dr. Clemens, I wonder if you could highlight just a little bit more for us if possible, he's got a lot of instructor time. So that's something before the advent of the combat training centers, the National Training Center, the Joint Readiness Training Center, the Joint Multi, whatever the one is in Germany, the JMRC, where you sent your really kind of cream of the crop was the schoolhouses, Fort Leavenworth, Carlisle Barracks, although before I was at Carlisle, it was actually in D.C., do we know what he did in those instructing assignments, or just know that he instructed?
I know he instructed there, but one thing I do know is as superintendent of West Point, he was big on getting the curriculum oriented towards counterinsurgency or kind of guerrilla warfare mindset there, because it's under the Kennedy administration, right? The Green Berets are a thing. And that's another kind of misconception and things that are something that a lot of people don't know about Westmoreland is that he understood that guerrilla warfare was a thing, and this is something that the United States needs to adapt to and to pay attention to, at least in some level.
So big picture, this is in the years after Eisenhower had a very rigid view of what the military should be, the Army kind of played a secondary role in that, then Kennedy comes in with a flexible response. So would you say Westmoreland is simply responding to the new administration's priorities, or is he somebody who is kind of ahead of the curve on this?
I've never heard anything that he was somehow like a pioneer in this kind of thinking, but he was definitely open to the idea of Taylor's idea of a flexible army, one that could fight along the conflict spectrum and, you know, a number of different contingencies from kind of counter-guerrilla stuff all the way up through conventional, mid-intensity stuff all the way up through kind of large-scale operations as well, too.
So oftentimes, Westmoreland in popular is kind of seen as an unthinking general, the guy that just spouts the party line, off he goes from there. Does this resume point to that, or is he a little bit more thoughtful than maybe we give him credit for?
Well, I mean, the resume, if you look at it traditionally, he looks like you're just your kind of conventional-minded military officer based upon his experience, his education, all that stuff as well, too. But what a lot of the revisionist scholars are showing, that simply was not the case with him. So, I think if you just, on paper, you would seem that, he's just trying to fight World War II in Southeast Asia, which is a big critique from a lot of his critics and people who are very skeptical of his command in Vietnam. But I don't think it bears out, actually, once you are in Vietnam and you look at the actual mindset and the things he says and the things he does as well, too.
Well, the reason I'm kind of keying off that is that this is not somebody who's just done the Army school thing. He seems to be an educated thinking man just from the what we see on paper here.
All right.
Yeah, and the Harvard Business School thing kind of stands out. And I want to ask again, Dr. Nance, as our 20th century U.S. conventional army specialist, one, how common was it to go from artillery to airborne? And two, how common was it for somebody of his age to go to, like, Harvard Business School?
The airborne thing was pretty common, particularly back then. The airborne was kind of seen as the new cool thing that was going on. So you, particularly those of a certain group of individuals, went there. Bear in mind, where are Ridgway and Gavin at the end of the Second World War? They're perking their way through. I think there's a new book called The Airborne Mafia that talks about that talks about the role and influence of these airborne generals in that time frame. So that is fairly common, although I would say is that anybody out of their who attends airborne school out of their 20s is a bold individual, particularly back then, because those parachutes did not land soft. Mm-hmm. In terms of the Harvard Business School, that was something that the Army actually did quite well during that era, was send officers to graduate schools. It still does that today. But the fact that he's going to Harvard Business School, that meant that somebody was grooming him to be on just a cookie-cutter officer.
Mm-hmm. The same way as we've talked about, people went through China before World War II is kind of the grooming process, it sounds like. So let's jump him into theater then, no pun intended. 1964 is a fraught year to assume command of MACV. So what's he walking into? What's the situation on the ground? What did his predecessor, Paul Harkins, kind of prepared him for?
Okay, yeah. By the time he takes command in 1964, you already have a hybrid insurgency which has metastasized throughout the length and breadth of South Vietnam. Including some, and this is controversial, but I don't know yet, or debatable, whether or not as early as 62 or 63, there were, in fact, North Vietnamese Army, large conventional forces in the South. But nonetheless, there is a insurgency which has metastasized throughout the country. There's a lot of political instability. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of humiliating defeats for the South Vietnamese military forces who are not doing so well. So he really inherits kind of a messy situation down there.
Mm-hmm. Now, one thing I want to just parse, because this is very, very important, and I think a lot of people get wrong, is you use the term insurgency very specifically, right? So what is an insurgency, and how is that different from just a war?
Okay, right. Yeah, no, that's, well, the insurgency, particularly why it's a hybrid insurgency, it's just the use of conventional forces paired with guerrilla forces. But also, part of the insurgency was genuinely homegrown in the South. Stay behinds, when Vietnam was partitioned in 1954, formed kind of early counter, like subversive cells down there. And then, as the first president of South Vietnam, Ngo Dinh Diem, tries to rip out communism root and branch and these cells and anybody that was sympathetic to communism in the South, he in very many ways, through his kind of autocratic heavy-handed tactics, creates even more insurgents as well. So this is partly homegrown in the South.
So an insurgency is an effort to overthrow a government.
To topple the regime, yes, because that's the whole idea. They need to topple the Saigon regime and reunify the country under Hanoi's control.
So an insurgency is not necessarily a guerrilla war, because you highlighted it's a hybrid fight.
Yes.
Can you kind of pull that apart a little bit more?
Yeah, sure, because even the hybrid forces in the South were not all guerrilla forces. Guerrillas tended to be, you had some full-time guerrilla forces, but a lot of them were part-time, a lot of them were local. You had kind of like militia-type organizations that were part of it. You had something known as the Viet Cong infrastructure, which was a shadow government or political military infrastructure in the South. But you also had full-time guerrillas as well, too, who fought like main forces did. Now, again, we say this is not combined arms warfare. They're essentially light infantry. But in their numbers and the way that they actually approach, fighting the Southern... The South Vietnamese and American conventional forces, they're aimed at that as well, too.
Yeah, and one of the reasons Dr. Nance is belaboring this is these definitions have gotten really confused over the last 25 years, particularly in the global war on terror. Yeah. We've essentially made insurgency, guerrilla warfare, even revolutionary warfare, hybrid warfare, all mean the same thing, and they don't. They each have different meanings. That's why we have different terms.
Yes.
Yeah, so... Let's talk a little bit about kind of the bigger background, right? Because I mentioned 64 is kind of a fraught year. So Kennedy and Diem both have just died
yes.
in the prior year.
Yeah.
The new administration has very little experience with foreign policy. Lyndon Johnson, of course, is kind of a Senate heavy. And he doesn't seem to know what to do with Vietnam, which is why he retains a lot of Kennedy's foreign policy apparatus. Yeah. And then we have this MACV structure, where I think it's fair to say in 1964 it's not exactly mature. So let's start there. When Westmoreland shows up at MACV, what's he walking into? What is this MACV thing in 1964?
Okay, well, it's largely still an advisory organization. The switch from Military Assistance Advisory Group, or MAG, to Military Assistance Command Vietnam was just really initially to for larger amounts of aid, if you will, mm-hmm. a larger organization. So it's still an advisory role up until 1965, mm-hmm. and then it transitions over to a combat role, which kind of you have mission creep, and it morphs, and its role will drift and change from that point forward. So
when he shows up in 1964, what does he see as his role? It's just to support the Republic of South Vietnam's army?
Essentially, that's still, they're trying to right the ship of state, if you will, because things are really spiraling out of control. The South Vietnamese government and its armed forces are essentially on the ropes mm-hmm. In 1964. Because what happens is after Diem is assassinated, you have a revolving door of poor leadership and these subpar, you know, military commanders who simply have no experience running a government. So that's an opportunity, or Hanoi sees it as an opportunity to really push forward. That's when they start sending North Vietnamese Army regulars in large numbers down to try to deliver a knockout blow before the Americans can intervene any further. So things are rapidly diminishing out of control, but it's still advisory until Rolling Thunder will then later kick up. I mean, after the Gulf of Tonkin in August of 1964, Johnson has punitive airstrikes. Naturally, there's going to be a larger air presence and footprint for the bases and everything you need. And then, of course, they're going to have to bring in ground forces to defend those. So it's a mission creep, and it slowly escalates over time.
So when we say advisory, what are we really talking about? What are these guys doing?
They're essentially providing advice and support, and oftentimes coordinating South Vietnamese forces in the field. Mm-hmm. Sometimes individuals were, in fact, you had advisors who were, you know, actively shooting and, you know, fighting themselves, but it was a very small scale. It was not the sanctioned, and it was not the official thing going on yet at that point.
If I remember correctly, the first time U.S. forces are engaged is at Ott Bock in early 63, where there's some shooting, so it's something that's happened for a bit by the time he gets there.
It has, but it's not official policy, and there's not large numbers of combat troops. They still tend to be advisors who are just actively engaged in firefights and things like that.
And what we have to understand, recording this in the 2020s, is advisor used to actually mean advisor. It used to just mean advising.
Yes.
It wasn't a euphemism for fighting.
Right.
Vietnam helps to change that.
Oh, right, yeah. Yes.
So does Westmoreland play a role in kind of this theater strategy stuff, the events around Tonkin, Johnson's shift from advising to ground forces, Rolling Thunder, naval forces, or is he just kind of the receiver?
He's kind of the receiver. There's no real true unity of command in that theater at all. There's no control of strategic assets by Westmoreland. He's purely in control or in charge and command of the ground war in the South and any air support related to that ground up, those ground operations. But the Navy fought their own war, the Air Force fought their own war, and Westmoreland didn't have control over those assets.
Is that something he wanted, or is that something he just accepted?
Well, there wasn't a lot of pushback from him. I mean, he was like a lot of other conventional-minded kind of military officers at the time, that Johnson's policy of graduated pressure, graduated response, this kind of incremental approach to you know, apply increasing intensity of combat operations to try to reach some kind of threshold or crossover so Hanoi would realize they can't win this war. It would just hurt too much that they would stop their efforts to try to conquer the South. He would ask for more combat forces, and essentially he grew the ground war. But the other aspects, I've never read anything, or he was kind of a soldier who believed in this is what the boss wants, he wasn't very outspoken against Johnson administration, as most general officers back then were not.
So it almost sounds like he sees himself as more of a tactical, like, ground force commander rather than a theater commander. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yeah, and he's, remember, he's, the strategy that he's handed as well, too, is carefully prescribed, right? There's no, he cannot invade with the North Vietnamic ground forces, cannot go into Laos and Cambodia, which that's where the Ho Chi Minh Trail was located. That's where thousands and thousands of North Vietnamese Army forces, as the war developed, will set up base areas and safe havens and use as launching platforms into the south. He can't go there as well either. So that's one of the reasons why he adopts this strategy of attrition. It's not because he was fresh out of ideas. It's just simply there were no. He was not allowed any other options. And even, so that's essentially.
How much does his experience and his understanding of the Korean War, where something similar, though different, occurred as well? How is that playing into his thought process?
And I'm sure it's there because attrition worked in Korea, right? We eventually forced the North Koreans and the Chinese to agree to a ceasefire. Yes, there was no negotiated settlement and the war technically is still ongoing. But attrition seemed to work in Korea, right? This idea of just applying so much pain and firepower to eventually compel them to agree to some kind of ceasefire. So he's thinking along those lines as well, too, for a certain degree, mm-hmm. right? But the whole reason, another thing, is that he understood the role of U.S. combat forces, right? It's doctrine, it's technology, it's training. The best that it could do would be to, and its purpose for being there was to serve as a shield to provide security so that nation building in the South Vietnamese can get their own house in order and build a nation for themselves. Mm-hmm. Right? He understood it was their country. We can't do this for you. What we can do, however, is use our strengths against the enemy's military strengths to try to provide that secure kind of environment so that the political aspects of this war can continue. And there's not much he could do outside of that except, all right, we can't go north, we can't go right west. Attrition is what we got to rely on here.
So we kind of have talked about what he doesn't have, right? He doesn't have the theater assets a joint commander would have now. He doesn't have freedom of action outside of the rules of engagement. So let's talk about what he does have. So by the time we escalate, we start pouring troops in, they peak in 1968, which is his last year of command. What does McAvee turn into? What assets does he have to use?
Okay, well, he's got a thoroughly large conventional force. 1965, his initial, the strategy he lays out in 1965 is a tiered kind of strategy. It's a phased strategy. The first thing was obviously to get whatever combat forces you could over there to South Vietnam to, quote unquote, stem the tide, right? To blunt the expansion of the communist, this hybrid insurgency in the South, right? To just simply stop the further spread of the communists and the gains they had been gaining pretty steadily from 1960 up through 1965. That was phase one. Phase two then was going to be to transition over to the offense, but that was also going to take time to build all that combat power logistically. He's still playing by this graduated response in which can't really move until, right, Johnson, comes to the conclusion that, all right, this is not working. We got to escalate a little bit further. So he's kind of dancing on the strings of Johnson and McNamara's graduated response as well, too. But they're fighting while building up combat power, building up massive, logistical capacities as bases. They're building fire bases there, air bases. Infantry is obviously building in size and scope, number of divisions. Airborne brigades come over there as well, too. So he's armor as well, too, whether they were M113 personnel carriers or tanks. So air mobility now is another thing as well, too, and that's something he does have control of, that type of assets and fixed-wing aircraft as far as the tactical fight in the South. But it's a thoroughly conventional, like, LISCO fight that's going on.
What's his command relationship with the South Vietnamese Army?
The top-ranking officers is about as good as you can get. It's really when you go down in the ranks, when you are talking, kind of province or district-level command, where there's friction between the Americans and the South Vietnamese. But at the highest levels, they got a pretty good relationship, as far as I know. I've never heard of anything kind of going off the rails.
Now, does he have command authority over the South Vietnamese army, or cooperational?
No, cooperational. He does not have command control. The United States and South Vietnamese do not conduct joint operations by any means. They're kind of doing their separate things. Separate fights. And as the American combat presence increases, the South Vietnamese conventional forces get marginalized. Now, they're not taking an active role in fighting the large NVA units. That's what the United States is doing.
So Westmoreland has a reinforced corps, small field army of American forces, a relationship with a national army of the South Vietnamese, which is, call it a field army in terms of equivalent, probably a little bit larger, but I know it was divided up into four or five different core regions.
There were four different corps.
So call it a field army of South Vietnamese. He has access to, but not command over, American Air Force and American Naval forces.
The Air Force is in a tactical sense in the South, yes, but no, not the Navy. The Navy did that. And some kind of riverine operations and stuff to a certain degree. Yes.
And then he also has a response. So he has got these units, they're fighting in Vietnam, but he also, has he relinquished his responsibility to train or advise the South Vietnamese Army?
No, that's still ongoing, but the thing is, it really atrophies right over time. While between 65 and 68, the emphasis of combat forces or U.S. forces that are over there are supplying U.S. forces who are doing a large degree of fighting, right? Mm-hmm. There is still some advisory level, but that kind of tapers off. It's later on when the United States starts withdrawing that the emphasis gets put back on advising.
So he is fulfilling dual hat, basically. He is the tactical commander on the ground, one might argue operational commander.
Right.
And he is also the advising commander.
I don't know how to convincingly answer that. I don't know 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, because again, once the United States starts the combat role, the advisement and kind of training of the South Vietnamese gets pushed to the side. It gets put on the back burner, if you will.
So he puts that hat in the closet.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it is a good question, and I don't know exactly the details of that.
One of the reasons we're struggling with this is people might be aware of a law passed in the 1980s called Goldwater-Nichols, which set a lot of these relationships in law, including the inherent jointness of a command like Westmoreland's. But, of course, that didn't exist at the time, and Vietnam is one of the reasons why that comes in. So it's hard to talk about this stuff in modern context, right? And we're all kind of nodding because we all understand there are problems here. But they couldn't fix them at the time because there's a conflict going on.
We had the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The South Vietnamese had the Joint General Staff.
Mm-hmm.
And there was almost a mirror image of everything from countrywide command to military corps command, right? The military region command down to the district province level as well.
There's Arvin Marines for reasons that don't really make sense.
Right. That's the other thing as well too. The South Vietnamese have conventional forces, and they have something later on which gets a lot of emphasis after Tet, which are known as territorial forces. But they have their own army, the Arvin, right, the Army of Vietnam. They have their own Air Force, their own Navy, their own Marines, their own kind of airborne and special operators as well too.
So let's complicate his life a little bit further, because he's also, for lack of a better term, the theater commander. He's the highest ranking army officer on the ground.
Yes.
So what is his relationship then with the political side of the South Vietnamese government? Does he hand this off entirely to the ambassador? What's that relationship look like there? And what are his responsibilities?
Well, initially, when civilians, there was a division of labor when it came to the military aspect and the nation-building pacification type aspects during the advisory period. That continues. They're still trying to find their feet and try to figure out who's going to do what throughout 65, throughout 66, and it's not until 1967 in which, when they create the Civil Operations and Revolutionary Development Support, or CORDS, they bring in Bob Comer and later, I forget, why am I drawing a blank on him, but I'll get back to it. Who has the ambassador, who has the equivalent of civilian rank as Westmoreland there, but he's in charge. Comer was, I don't want to say Chester Cooper, it was not, I can't remember his name, became head of the CIA with glasses. Oh, I should know this, but I can't think of it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait, no.
It's okay.
Yeah, so, I won't forget. But anyway, so that's where you really have kind of not equal weight that's given, but there's more emphasis with an ambassador who's in charge of the pacification aspects of it. Even though there are military things going on inside the pacification program, right? People like Comer and others were supposed to be on equal footing with Westmoreland.
So I know in the earlier years, the Paul Harkins, MAG years, the ambassador was technically the highest ranking executive, and he commanded the military forces. No, he wouldn't actually like go, you know, take a gun. Did that continue through the Westmoreland years, or did that relationship kind of parallel?
As far as my understanding, no, I've never heard of anything like
yeah,
that.
So it kind of paralleled then. And you you mentioned something I want to talk about too, which is this CORDS organization. I think it's fair to say one of the things Westmoreland is most criticized for ex post facto is that he didn't bother fighting the unconventional part. He just wanted to recreate, as you said, World War II and Vietnam. So what is CORDS, what is it doing, and how is it part of Westmoreland's strategy?
Okay, right. No, that's a great question. Part of this, an effort that was known as pacification, it had many different names. Revolutionary development, rural reconstruction, pacification. They settled on pacification, which was unfortunate because that's what the French used, and that had, you know, that helped kind of undermine.
Colonialist.
Yes, yeah, this kind of, you know, neo-imperialist undertones to it.
Sure, there's no backlash that could happen there.
right, exactly. But essentially what CORDS was meant to do, and what Westmoreland understood, is that this is, you know, the nation-building aspect and the political side of this fight is something that has to be, you know, we have to pay attention to. And he understood that you did need to pay attention to it. But when he comes in 65, and this is in a lot of the literature, he looks at this hybrid threat and he says, South Vietnam, metaphorically, is a house that's under attack by two different entities. One are the bully boys, he called them, which were the People's Army of Vietnam, PAVN, or the North Vietnamese Army regulars, synonymous. But these were the equivalent. Their main forces are the kind of these big burly dudes with crowbars and giant necks, or no necks, I should say, who were trying to attack and tear down that house. Meanwhile, you also have the termites. He uses that metaphor, right? Who were really the insurgents and the infrastructure, the kind of low-level, mid kind of guerrilla activities who worked together. And he said, they're also attacking that house. They're also a threat. Anybody who's ever had termites understands, right? Those little buggers can do some damage given time. But the more pressing and immediate threat are those bully boys, those North Vietnamese Army regulars. That's also what the United States military, that's the threat that is best equipped to fight. We can't do nation building for the South Vietnamese. It will reek like neo-colonialism. It look like we're just trying to replace the French. It's not what the army is trained to do. We don't know the language. We don't know the terrain. We don't know that stuff. So he understood that kind of the dual nature of that conflict, and that the best thing that the United States can do, and its purpose for being there, the United States military and combat forces, was again to provide security and a shield behind which those pacification and nation building activities can take place, and the Saigon regime can get its house in order, provide good things for the population, root out corruption, and eventually, you know, form a nation.
Mm-hmm. And something you mentioned on knowing the language, just one thing that we spend some time with our students here is, and it's nice having international students here, is you ask an international student, preferably from somewhere that's not very familiar with the United States, and you ask them, who's from the Northeast? Who are the American students who are from the Northeast? And they can't pick it out.
Right.
And of course, anybody that's been in the U.S. can tell very quickly. I know you're from the Jersey area. Why? Because, you know, I've listened to you talk for a little bit. You made some references, and it comes out very, very clearly and distinctly. Mm-hmm. Whereas somebody who's not from that area can't tell that. And I'm reminded very forcibly of Iraqi battalion commander. We killed some insurgents and guerrillas, actually in those cases synonymous in this particular case. And he's going, that guy's this nationality. And I would not have known. Right. But he could tell just from what it is. So when you're talking about Westmoreland knowing this, there's actually a degree of sophistication there that I think often gets mixed over in just the, hey, we speak the same language.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he understands, and it's been, he's on the record so many times saying, right, this, we understand this is a political fight, and that the reason why we're here is to enhance pacification. It's in his directives. It's in the strategy he lays out. Mm-hmm. And the language is there. So, I mean, I'm very sympathetic with this, the Westmoreland revisionism, which really doesn't start until the 2000s, mm-hmm. When you have a number of people, some who use primary source documents and use that as a form of reassessment. Other people who just do a kind of general overview, all the way up through kind of full book-length treatments of, you know, reevaluating his generalship. And I think they're absolutely right. I mean, if you look at this honestly, and look at what Westmoreland said and had done, you know, he was not what critics had claimed he was earlier.
So let's talk about what he was doing in this kind of 64 to particularly 67 period. As U.S. force numbers are ramping up, as the conflict is turning more and more hybrid, more and more violent, how are these methods working? How is it working on the ground?
Okay. Well, essentially, that's what search and destroy is for, right? To go out and find where the enemy is, make contact, and then call in artillery and airstrikes to just blow them off the map. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that despite all the searching by U.S. and allied forces, it was really the Vietnamese communists who initiated these engagements. They tended to be very short, very brief. For a while, they would like to get right up close to American combat units to prevent, right, to the get with inside that umbrella.
Right? Belt-holding earth, believe.
Yeah. Hold them by their, grab them by their belts to fight them, right, that kind of stuff. But essentially, it was a lot of kind of either through air mobility, right, through armor, through infantry, humping it in the bush, if you will, to just go out, search out the enemy, find them in these kind of very chaotic, brief, intense firefights, and then they would break off. The Vietnamese communists would be able to escape across the border into Laos and Cambodia, or into any number of base camps which were right inside of South Vietnam, including war zones and something called the Iron Triangle, which was in and around Saigon, Military Region 3.
And they just have to watch them run away, right?
You couldn't even see them. It was one of the ideas that you never saw them. They'd come up and they would simply just disappear and blend back into the very rugged terrain, double, triple canopy jungle, mountainous regions as well.
So, retired Colonel Nance, you've mentioned you kind of have done this, not in Vietnam, but in Iraq. put us on the ground as much as you can. What is this like for these soldiers who are basically being told to walk out, get shot at, and then kill more of the enemy?
That's an apt description. There's a joke video that goes around like, okay, we're gonna go around and drive around until someone shoots at us. Then we're gonna try and kill them, and then they're gonna run away, and then we're gonna try and catch them. Mm-hmm. And it's a joke, but there's actually a fairly significant amount of truth to it. And now what's interesting is that it does a couple things, right? Which is one, if they don't decide to fight you, you have some freedom of movement to do there. It is nerve-wracking, as all get out, though, when you're driving around streets just literally waiting for something to blow up or explode. Mm-hmm. But when the enemy does decide to engage you, that is often the opportunity to kill that individual and remove that guy from the fight. The hard part you face is, are you killing enough of them? Mm-hmm. And are you killing the right guys? Because particularly in Mosul, the people we were killing most of the time, mm-hmm. were the guys that were southwest Mosul. We were fighting mostly street thugs that were armed and encouraged by Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. So you kill two or three street thugs, I mean, the local population thanks you. But really, you need something else targeting that.
Right.
Which leads me to the kind of question I was going to ask Dr. Clemens here, which is, we're sitting here, we're trading blows, and finally in the 90s we started to get the scholarship coming out of North Vietnam to see what the North Vietnamese thought of this. So while we're having our own frustrations of these brief violent encounters and we're seeing our casualties stack up, how do the North Vietnamese view this period?
Okay, right. Well, they understood the damage that, I mean, force had utility in South Vietnam to a certain degree in the fact that we killed the hell out of these guys, right? These young guys would come down the Ho Chi Minh Trail almost to their certain deaths in tens and thousands, right? So it had a negative impact, and they understood the damage it was causing, but several things were going on. One thing, those strategic restrictions on where the United States forces can go, particularly into Laos and Cambodia, right, and North Vietnam, gave them a giant rear area, right, which they were kind of off limits, and these safe havens, in Laos and Cambodia. And that's the thing. They were able to a certain degree, right, limit their casualties by crossing into those areas, and they know the United States would not follow them in there. Another thing they had going for them, and this is something that was never properly calculated by the Johnson administration, is that the idea that we would simply kill enough of them that they would not be able to reconstitute those losses, but just natural population growth in North Vietnam meant that at year after year they were able to send as many as needed, right, military forces to do what they actually had done there at that time as well. And the third thing is the idea of a crossover point that we were going to somehow destroy Hanoi's will was just, again, underestimating your enemy, because they were not going to stop no matter what. They didn't care how many young guys they had to send down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to their certain deaths year after year, how long it took. I mean, there were some concerns. It's not like time was always on their side, or was always a luxury. They never had to worry about it, because the Chinese and the Soviets at times would pressure them to dial things down as well. And there were no guarantees that Beijing or Moscow were going to, indefinitely support their war, give them what they wanted to. It's right. Part of the Sino-Soviet split, which compelled both of those two to provide the aid Hanoi needed at one time or the other. But that being said, they were determined, come hell or high water, we are going to see this thing through till complete victory. So their will, as we thought we could break it, was not going to be broken by any means.
So we have kind of this push-pull with Westmoreland focused more on the main force fight, but still doing counterinsurgency things. The North Vietnamese taking huge losses, but still absorbing them. Is it fair to say that 68 is the year that changes the equilibrium as we move into Tet? So this is the thing that really gets Westmoreland kind of on the bad list for most people. Walk us through this process. He gives this infamous speech in late 67 where he assesses the war at the National Press Club, and then Tet happens. So what's he doing during this, and why does it reflect so poorly on him?
Okay. Right. Well, he was part of a chorus in the summer and autumn of 1967, which was talking about progress. Maxwell Taylor jumps the shark. He says, we're winning the war. It's being won. But he was a lone voice. Right. But despite that, Johnson, McNamara, Ambassador Ellsworth Bunker are all using that term, progress. Westmoreland himself comes back to the United States in the autumn. He delivers a speech before a joint session of Congress, and he doesn't say the war's won. He says a lot of hard fighting ahead of us, but the end is beginning to come in view, that the final phase is within our grasp.
Now, is this his idea, or is he doing this on behalf of the administration?
No, by all measurable accounts, and again, this is what was hard about this conflict, is how do you measure progress? Body count is always the one that everybody knows, and again, that's something that's been used to kind of smear Westmoreland as some kind of mindless troglodyte. But the reality is, how else in a war without front lines can you really measure progress? Mm-hmm. One way was body count. However, there was another way, is that part of this pacification program was measuring both security, levels of security in South Vietnam, and development, schools and things that they were building, and children and animals that were being inoculated against disease, and how much crop, rice crop was being grown and getting to market, that kind of stuff. So, and by all metrics available, progress in security was being made. Now, whether that meant we were extending progress out to the countryside or people were fleeing into already secure areas, those numbers were, in fact, going up over time. Mm-hmm. So based upon that, I don't believe that Westmoreland was out there to lie or to pull the wool over the American people's eyes or to just simply do the bidding or parrot exactly what Johnson wanted him to say. I think there was genuine optimism, both in Military Assistance Command, Westmoreland, and in the White House and Department of Defense, that this was paying off, that we were seeing some degree of progress. And so, that's why he goes on it. But when Tet, because it's so sudden, because obviously Westmoreland misreads the intelligence, something else, I think, in hindsight, it's easy to say, oh, how could he have missed this thing, right? But, as we know, intelligence, there were a million you know, pinpoints that you have to try to make sense of, and he thought it was going to be another kind of big kind of conventional fight, not what actually happened in January, May, and August of 68.
So there's a conundrum here that we as historians have worked to untangle since 1968, which is the insurgency essentially ceases to exist. It is virtually destroyed. It has to be rebuilt.
It's severely damaged.
Right, and
yes.
We forget there are Tets after Tet, right? There's many Tets the rest of the year.
Yes, it wasn't just what happens at the end of January.
Right. Yeah. Huge failure on the part of the communist forces, and I use that term to encompass all of them.
Yeah.
We now have the initiative as the Americans, but also as the South Vietnamese, and yet this is seen as the beginning of the end. And one of the things I like to do to my students, and I encourage listeners to find this video, you can find it online, Westmoreland gives a press conference from the embassy lawn, surrounded by reporters and a very funny major in like full battle kit. And as he's talking about how things are fine, there's stuff blowing up behind him. There are probably still bodies on the embassy lawn. And it just makes him look stupid and out of touch. So how do we get at that dissonance? How does Westmoreland seem and sound so stupid, and yet we clearly know he's not?
Right, and that's an unfortunate moment in time. I mean, on one hand, he's reading the tactical reality, and that is, yes, the People's Liberation Armed Forces, the armed wing of the National Liberation Front, successfully over a series of months and weeks infiltrated the cities, snuck in weapons, used the opportunity to Tet Holiday to launch this unprecedented, unexpected attack for all the world to see, right, from the age of television now. And the reality is when they came out of hiding, they got cut down in large numbers. And with very few exceptions, the city of Hue in the north, or north of the northern portion of South Vietnam being one, the imperial city, and in Saigon, certain suburbs of Saigon, these things were put down almost immediately within a matter of hours or days. Mm-hmm. So whether he was, that interview is based upon intelligence he was getting from a number of different regions, despite maybe a few things going off around him, that we never know. But it is unfortunate, and it does sound, that's kind of the cherry on top of, again, this kind of chorus of talks of progress throughout the summer and fall of 1967, in which mm-hmm. the American people kind of got lulled into a sense of complacency, and then all of a sudden they see this on their television sets, and it is absolutely shocking and disillusioning for most people.
And I would like to point out, again, I encourage listeners to watch the video. I think part of it is Westmoreland looks the part of the knuckle dragger, right? He's really strong chin. He looks like he's off a recruiting poster. He literally laughs his way through the interview, like he doesn't have a care in the world.
I've never seen it. I have got to find
it. It's amazing. Yet. It is. If you want to know why the war in Vietnam went sideways, that minute 30-second clip is a good indicator of why.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's one of just the many visuals and things out of the Tet Offensive, which just most people could not get their heads wrapped around.
Now, but what's interesting, though, is as you pointed out, though, is that Westmoreland is seeing this, and the enemy has graciously impaled themselves on his defenses and made it where he can actually do all the firepower that's useful. But what do we know? Because the American people often look at Tet as the North Vietnamese twirling their mustaches and saying, yes, everything is proceeding as we have foreseen it. We now know that's the farthest thing from the truth, right? So why did the North Vietnamese even launch this offensive, and then what did they think about it immediately after it happened?
Okay, although this is Hanoi's brainchild, and particularly Lê Duẩn, the secretary of the Politburo, this is largely a People's Liberation Armed Forces or Viet Cong fight. Right? The NVA is involved in largely the diversionary attacks up in the north, Khe San, along the borders with Laos and Cambodia, in and around the Parrot's Beak and Fish Hook, where these areas where they penetrate into South Vietnam from Cambodia. They're kind of traditional avenues, the Central Highlands and Hue up in the north. Other than that, this was largely the People's Liberation Armed Forces fight, and they come up and they fight in large numbers. There have been accusations, and there was a lot of bitterness among the National Liberation Front and the People's Liberation Armed Forces, who argued that they were set up, that Hanoi wanted this to happen. I mean, again, it just... I don't think that's the case, but it was largely that Southern insurgency's fight, but as Dr. Abel pointed out before, they are absolutely devastated. Not completely destroyed, right, but they are severely damaged as a result of this.
So why launch Tet at all? Is this because they're, why are they trying to do something different here?
break the stalemate. And this is something else as well, too. This was a stalemate for the United States, something that Tet, like a dash of cold water, right, on the face of American public opinion, revealed. The war, despite 3 years of increasing escalation, increasing blood and treasure, we seem to be no farther along. The end is not coming into view. Same thing from Hanoi's point of view. They understand that Westmoreland's search and destroy and clear and hold, his big unit war of attrition, is having a definitive impact on their ability to continue this, right? Again, they're looking over their shoulders always at the Chinese and the Soviets. So they have to do something themselves. But for them, because they had a much more well-balanced strategy, which was not just military operations, but political things going on, information operations, and particularly diplomacy, they understood that American public opinion was a center of gravity that they could target. So that was meant to do that as well, too. Right? If they can inflict severe damage on South Vietnam's armed forces and rapidly collapse the Saigon government, the Americans would have no choice but to leave, right? Because their whole reason for being there would be gone. So that was essentially it. If they could do that, if they could really beat up Arvin, if they could have another general uprising, and Lê Duẩn and the Politburo hardliners truly believed, right? They were getting high on their own supply, that the South Vietnamese people overall detested the Saigon regime, were just simply looking for an opportunity to do what they did in 1945, which was to assume control for themselves, right? Make the urban areas ungovernable, take control of the kind of the organs of government, and that's the end of the story. So that's really what they were hoping to do. They thought this general uprising would happen if they just inflicted enough military damage. But if it should fail, right, they also knew that American public opinion was a fragile thing, and that's something that they could target for effect, and it worked.
So 68 is certainly the year that changes things for Westmoreland. By the end of the year, McNamara is out of a job. Westmoreland is not out of a job. In fact, he gets promoted upwards. And he has this kind of weird post-Vietnam career where he's the officer tasked with overseeing the transition to the all-volunteer force. Mm-hmm. But what does he do after he leaves Vietnam? Does he go on the kind of apology tour that McNamara does, or does he just keep his silence?
No, he doesn't keep his silence. I mean, he writes a soldier reports. He writes his own memoirs in which he's a lot more critical than he was while in uniform, obviously.
Right.
But also, he doesn't completely throw like Johnson or anything under the bus. So he kind of gives his side of the story. He's embroiled in a lawsuit, too, over the intelligence where he was accused of deliberately inflating numbers. And they ran a news expose, and he was going to sue CBS News. And they finally settled out of court or something like that. So he's in the public eye, but not as much as you would think. He's more focused on, as you pointed out, resurrecting the army, reforging that broken sword to transition over to the all-volunteer force, save the institution that he himself served his whole life and loved, because it was essentially wrecked by Vietnam and the way it was conducted. Mm-hmm. So he's focused more on that. But he's somewhat in the public eye, and he's out there giving his side of the story and writing and doing other things related to the war in Vietnam.
So let's talk then.
But he's not apologizing like.
Right, right. Like McNamara did.
Yes,
so
no, absolutely.
Yeah. So let's kind of land this by talking about how historians have viewed him since. And I think you've kind of intimated there's basically two camps. One of them, I think, is fair to say, emerges during the war, perhaps, I won't say infected, but influenced by the anti-war movement.
Right, right.
So what's kind of the standard line after the war? What do people in the 70s through even the present say a kind of bad Westmoreland?
Okay, pretty much. I mean, it starts, one of the early kind of takes in early history is by Gunther Louis, America in Vietnam. And I forget that came out in like 1979 or 1980 or something. And that's pretty critical of him. And that makes a lot of those same charges. Unimaginative, inflexible, conventionally minded, did a lot of stuff wrong. That was later on picked up throughout the 90s by people like Andrew Krepinevich, right, who wrote to the Army in Vietnam, who says the reason why we lost this war is because we didn't focus on counterinsurgency. Right? Westmoreland, by focusing on his big unit war of attrition, ignored counterinsurgency, hence we lost the war. Very critical of that as well, too. John Nagle is one of them, who also in his book, Learning to Eat Soup with a Knife, also makes the argument we didn't pay enough attention to counterinsurgency. Mm-hmm. That's why we lost that particular war. And then, of course, Louis Sorley is the biggest kind of Westmoreland hater, if you will, right, who just simply blames the war all on Westmoreland. Essentially, that's really it in a nutshell, right? He's trying to refight World War II, doesn't get the political aspect, and lost the war because he ignored that political aspect.
And a couple of the foils I've seen for Westmoreland, if we could talk about them at least briefly, is one, when Creighton Abrams comes in to replace him, he does things differently. And two, you often hear from Marines and people who, you know, are kind of attuned to Marine histories that the Marines had this right from the beginning. So what do you make of those two kind of, like I said, foils to Westmoreland?
Okay, right. The early one, when you talk about people like Victor Krulak and the Marines and their combined action platoon, Westmoreland was not oblivious to the success of the combined action platoon program. However, he still understood those bully boys are out in the countryside. And you have these small units penny parceled out throughout the countryside. They're just going to get steamrolled by, you know, these, these Pavan regiments. They're just going to roll over these guys. So although I understand that, I understand the concept, we simply don't have the resources to do that everywhere. And these small little units will get overrun. Again, those bully boys, the NVA regulars are the big problem. That's what we have to focus on. So that's kind of why the combined action platoon never really took off. Not only the NVA threat, but just we didn't have the resources to do it at scale throughout all of South Vietnam to make it successful.
Yeah.
As far as the Abrams and the better war thesis, Abrams doesn't do things much differently than Westmoreland does. He pays a little bit more attention to population security and the pacification aspect, but that's because he has the luxury to do so. He inherits a much more, a much better or positive strategic environment than Westmoreland has, in the fact that the insurgency is banged up, it's beat up. The only thing that keeps it alive after 68, up until the Easter Offensive, is the infusion of North Vietnamese Army regulars who were sent down, breaking up into smaller units to kind of beef those existing units up.
So no more bully boys.
That's something else. Another thing is they really can't do that anymore.
Yeah.
After Tet, Lê Duẩn finally realizes we can't do this again. It's going to take us time to reconstitute ourselves. So he's kind of chastened. So they passed something called Resolution Number 9, which goes back to kind of protracted Maoist-style guerrilla warfare, to kind of just stretch out and spread out the South Vietnamese and Americans while they're there, while they're withdrawing, right, just by constantly giving them dilemmas to address throughout South Vietnam while they're going to reconstitute themselves in the North to prepare for another big offensive. So, yeah, Abrams is only, the rap he gets is really because he inherits a better situation and has the ability to do this. It's also because by that point, Americans are leaving, they're withdrawing under Nixon's Vietnamization program as well, too. But it's also, Hanoi's laying low for the time being. They have to lay low. So he's able to do these things. And there is a genuine, right, the levels of security in South Vietnam are the highest they ever are. It's not just those numbers anymore. They're counting the data. It's also qualitative analysis, right? Just people are testifying, hey, it has never been this peaceful since, we haven't seen it this peaceful since the 1950s. So he kind of just steps into a very, fortuitous situation, which is what allows him to kind of get the credit for the high levels of security and claiming they can do things different. But at the tactical level, it was no different. He was doing search and destroy and sweep operations. Mm-hmm. For the first time under Abrams, actually, too, the war in populated areas in the Mekong Delta is actually fought by American forces, something that never happened up until that point. So it becomes a lot more deadlier for a lot more Vietnamese and rural areas under Abrams than it was for Westmoreland.
So that, I think, brings us to the kind of revisionist school that you talked about. And what we've been talking about in particular is an article we use in our lessons here by Dale Andrade, Westmoreland Was Right, which you can guess from the title is revisionist. So if you could walk us a little bit through kind of how that works.
Yeah, right. The first kind of shot at revisionism comes in 2004. John Carlin, who worked for the Center of Military History, at McNair in Washington, he put a primary source document, or two primary source documents, in the Journal of Military History called Winning the Vietnam War, Westmoreland's Approach in Two Documents. And he essentially blows holes in an idea that Westmoreland doesn't talk about pacification or didn't know that that's what we were doing there, right? And that our job is to get rid of those bad guys, provide security so that pacification can thrive. Mm-hmm. Those primary documents prove that. Dale Andrade picks it up in 2008 with the article that we use here in the H400 block of instruction, that Westmoreland was right, and that's it essentially. He makes the same argument. He understood the political dimensions. The threat was a hybrid threat. We had to focus on the bigger threat, so he gives him a lot of, you know, sympathy for that, for those decisions that were made there as well. He wasn't the only one. Andrew Birtle that same year put out something called Proven Westmoreland and the Historians, a Reappraisal. What are the reports that was generated? This Proven report was an assessment of the war in Vietnam that was made in 1966. And essentially, it was critical of the lack of effort for pacification and the focus on the main force war. Mm. It agreed with a lot of Westmoreland was doing, but the thing is, historians, the first phase of a historian's kind of cherry-picked and misinterpreted that report to be an indictment of Westmoreland, or just used some of the criticisms from that report to kind of beat him up and ignore the things that were kind of in agreement with what Westmoreland was doing at the time as well. Right. So Birtle does another good job of kind of resurrecting Westmoreland's image. And then in 2014, Greg Daddis puts out a book, a book-length treatment of American strategy in Vietnam and Westmoreland called Westmoreland's War. And he's essentially saying the same thing that those other guys are saying as well, too. Understood the political dimensions. This was a hybrid war he focused on. It was about the best strategy that you could have put together given the circumstances and then the political limitations and all the other things that were involved as well, too.
Yeah, and you said something very important here. You know, we don't do a ton of historiography on this podcast, but there is something I think listeners should take notice of. When you pointed out that this whole change in opinion happened with the publication of two primary source documents. And what had happened was the first cut historians hadn't fully treated the primary source documents. Now, in fairness, they may not have all been available, but still.
Right.
What I think people need to be aware of in the world of digitized sourcing, because a lot of the stuff is available digitally now and you can read it for yourself, is start there. You know, don't take someone's word that Westmoreland was bad or good.
Right.
You can look at his documents yourself and make those assessments yourself. And this is true not just for, you know, aspiring historians, but for people interested in these things as well.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, of course, obviously, people in the public rely on professional historians to do the archival work, to give their arguments, to present evidence, to back up their claims and all that stuff. And they rely on that to a certain degree. But I think, yeah, much like you have an alternate media, quote unquote, in the 21st century, you can have alternate historical criticism or critique as well, too, by people who can access a lot of these documents and things of that nature. I think the revisionist school in general related to Vietnam War and Westmoreland is good because it kind of synthesizes previous schools of thought, in which there tended to be these binaries, whether it was orthodox, revisionist, whether the war was unwinnable or winnable, whether it was a good war or a wicked war. Even with how the war was fought, the early cut of Vietnam history in Westmoreland was the idea of you had the hearts and minders, people like Kravinovich and Nagel, who argued we didn't pay attention to counterinsurgency. Had we done so, won their heart and minds, we would have won the war. Mm-hmm. Or you had Harry Summers, Clausewitzians, as they called them, who said, no, the true center of gravity was Hanoi and the Ho Chi Minh Trail and Laos and Cambodia. Had we gone after that, right, that the insurgency was really the symptom, not the cause of the disease.
Right.
And had we gone after that, we could have won. Where the revisionists, the individuals I named from before, they kind of say both of those schools are not exactly right, right?
Right.
And they kind of synthesize elements from both of those to critique, you know, what Westmoreland had actually done.
Yeah, and I think that's a good takeaway for people, kind of both, you know, practitioners, soldiers, planners, but also historians and people interested in history to understand. We often simplify things, but reality tends to be very complex. It can even be chaotic. And learning to understand what's real and what matters is the key.
Yeah, and that will come full circle to what you had said before with all these terms, right? Irregular warfare, insurgency, guerrilla warfare, hybrid warfare, gray zone warfare. You're simply talking a blend of conventional and unconventional means, information operations as well as kinetic operations, diplomacy, you know, the whole dime formula, whole of government approach.
Mm-hmm.
And I know those labels can be problematic sometimes because they can be confusing. I think they can be reductionist.
Mm-hmm.
Do not capture, as you said, the nuance and the shades that are involved in all these things, the complexity of these situations. But what else can you possibly do, human beings, in order to analyze things? We just we break things down, and sometimes we produce definitions mm-hmm. and terms that miss the bigger picture or the nuance of certain mm-hmm. conflicts.
No, absolutely. All right, so in our reassessment of William Westmoreland, final word, have we gotten him right as this kind of dumb, pig-headed World War II redux commander, or have we gotten him wrong?
The initial cut, we're wrong. Right? Okay. Andrade is correct. Westmoreland was, in fact, right. He didn't achieve what he wanted to. There were limits to military force. He, I don't think, recognized those limitations. But again, given the enemy, given the strategic constrictions within which he was placed, the strategy he applied was about as good as you were going to get, and he was not. He did understand the complexity of this war and its dual political and military nature as well.
All right, Dr. Clemis, thank you for helping us kick off a new series, and we really enjoyed it.
Yep, I did as well. Thank you very much.
If you like this episode, please make sure to check out our other podcast, Broad Gauge Gossips, where we talk to members of the Department of Military History faculty so you can get to know them.